This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Makerculture, taking things into our own hands.
A podcast series by 2009 online journalism students at Ryerson University in Toronto, Ontario.
And at the University of Western Ontario in London, Ontario.
Hello and welcome to the Maker Culture Podcast, co-published by Rabble.ca and TheTaiyi.ca. We're your hosts, Pia Bahili, Curtis File, and Kevin Young.
We're here to help you meet your makers. That's everyone from chefs and artists to web hackers, engineers, and a group of tenacious journalism students. In early September, 45 journalism students from Ryerson University and the University of Western Ontario set out on a journey to document the growing maker culture movement. What is maker culture?
At the core of maker culture is the idea that individuals have the power to affect change in their lives in an age of increasing globalization, centralization, and commercialization. It's about the replacement of consumerism with creativity and collaboration.
The idea for the series was developed by our classroom instructor, Wayne McPhail. Kevin and Pia caught up with him to discuss what maker culture is all about and where the idea came from.
So we're here with Wayne McPhail and the overseer of maker culture. And Wayne, can you tell us what sparked the idea of this whole project?
Yeah, I just started seeing sort of signs in a whole bunch of areas, including people who are making things, people are working with food, particularly journalists, citizen journalists. And I was seeing all sorts of early warnings that people were actually taking all sorts of things into their own hands and taking personal responsibility, not waiting for governments, not waiting for corporations to give them the things they need. And that really made me think that there was something going on here. If we could just sort of connect the really early threads of this kind of thing, we might be seeing some kind of movement that was starting, a ball that was starting to roll. And I think we've seen over the past couple of months that, in fact, it has been rolling downhill pretty quickly.
And what was your personal relationship to maker culture? Like, are you a maker? Did you know a lot about it before we started?
Well, certainly, you know, I was involved really heavily and have been for a number of years in Rabble.ca, which is a Canada-wide alternative journalism site. And so I've seen a lot of people do their own podcasts, and I have done my own podcast, and a lot of people who have taken the responsibility to cover themselves journalistically. And then I also started reading Cory Doctorow's book Makers, which he's made available online and has done for a number of months for free online. And I was reading that, and that sparked me to go to a hacker meetup in Hamilton, where I get to meet some makers who are actually working, talking about 3D printers, talking about doing their own circuitry, opening electronics up, and taking those things and sort of taking the belief that if you can't open it, you don't own it. And that really resonated with me because that's what I was seeing in politics. That's what I was seeing with citizen journalism, people who were taking something that had one function and remapping it to the function they wanted it to have. And that's pretty exciting.
And what does maker culture mean to you? How would you define it?
Really, the notion that there's an old saying, I think it's from like 1982, that a science fiction writer named William Gibson said that, you know, the street finds its own use for things. And I think that's a really tight way of talking about what maker culture is. It's people who understand that they can make change themselves, whether it's a change in a device or a change in the way something is used or a change in a political system or just the change of thinking about something, that they can actually make change, that their individuals have not only the ability to make change, but the responsibility to make change and to communicate that change and to share that change. So what it means to me is a really exciting time, a reaction against globalization, a reaction against consumerism, where people are actually saying, I can change things. I have the power to change, and I want to not only take things and add creative intellectual property to it, but not make it property, to make it a shared resource, to create a common good. And that idea of creating things and sharing things is what maker culture is all about.
And Wayne, people are getting the sense of this is only an online, perspective. Do you think not just one group, but everybody can relate to this?
Sure. I mean, one of the great things about what we're seeing now is, I mean, historically, people have already always been makers, right? Really, historically, it was a matter of survival. Now it's a matter of choice and response. But what's really exciting now is that people are not only making things, but they have this fantastic tool for sharing what they've learned. Whether it's open source recipes or it's software code or it's three-dimensional devices that they've created that other people can print out themselves on 3D printers or political structures that they've inherited from indigenous people or whatever, they have this fantastic vector to transmit this information and create community and create a sense of excitement and knowledge base around these things that they're making. And that's what's different now, and that's what it's exciting now.
And when you mentioned about bringing the community together, what else will this whole Maker Culture project bring?
It really brings a sense of diffuse conversation. You know, that historically it's been really expensive to bring a large group of people together. And so what you ended up with in corporations and organizations was a central command and control and a hierarchical structure, because that was the most efficient way to communicate. But now when people can communicate laterally, you have this wonderful, diffuse, non-centralized, non-command and control conversation, a global conversation that's going on to unite these niches of people interested in fabricating or recipes or politics or science or whatever. And to me, that's the really exciting thing, that you're democratizing the production of things. You're bringing stuff to a home level, to a local level, to even right into your own hands. And that's really powerful.
Our classroom discussions began with the discovery that people were working on advanced 3D printing. These were ordinary people that saw a huge potential for their homemade technology. So Christian Bergmeister, Jeff Turner, Matt Lundy, and Mike Kennedy from UWO went to investigate. The sound you are hearing is the creaking of a 3D printer as it recreates a simple button shape from a model that Christian came up with on his computer. I caught up with Jeff Turner to talk a little bit about the most interesting findings of the Fabricators episode. Here's part of that interview.
Probably the most interesting thing to me was the Fab Lab in Elyria. And a Fab Lab, again, this is the brainchild of Neil Gershenfeld. And the concept is to make a space available where really leading-edge fabrication technology is made available to people who wouldn't otherwise be involved with that stuff. So sort of taking it out of the hands of computer engineers and electrical engineers and putting it in the hands of people, ordinary people, people who have an interest in making things, but maybe somebody who in the past might have made a quilt for themselves or knitted a scarf, suddenly have access to this very powerful equipment that allows them to realize their creative vision in ways that were never possible before. And so the one in Elyria, Ohio, it's associated with the Lorain County Community Center, and it's an incredible space. They have a 3D printer, a really leading-edge 3D printer, laser cutters, laser etchers. They have a shop bot that allows them to, in two dimensions, cut out any patterns they want out of plywood, out of metal. And what was most interesting to me is the people who were participating in it. It wasn't geeks. It was, you know, sort of suburban housewives. It was guys who wanted to make parts for their car that weren't available anymore. You know, so people who wouldn't be using this technology normally or wouldn't even maybe have been aware of it until they came across this course in the college calendar. And they're right in there figuring this stuff out with the help of some really enthusiastic, enlightened people.
That was Jeff Turner from the University of Western Ontario. After learning about this new printing technology, we were compelled to find out how this movement was impacting our culture in a broader sense. The project expanded tenfold. We began investigating the various manifestations of the maker culture movement. Food, media, politics, personal fabrication, education, hackers, science, and the history and future of the movement. Out on the road, we discovered all kinds of interesting people. The science group found that a website existed where the everyman could help make scientific discoveries. We found change camps and grassroots movements that were getting people engaged with their government. The hackers found that people were taking technology and making it do what they wanted it to. I talked with Anna Delaney from the history group about the many makers she met on the road.
We went to St. Jacob's, which is an hour maybe 15 minutes outside of London. It's by Kitchener-Waterloo. We went there on Halloween, and we all woke up at 5 in the morning.
What was the most interesting thing you came across?
I think, well, the most interesting, I would say, is probably the different people who make their own things. And actually, I mean, it's a farmer's market, so they are there to sell and make money. But for so many people we spoke to, like, use their own things that they make. Like, we met a jewelry maker who only wears her own jewelry, pretty much. The painter hangs his own paintings in his home. And most of the food people, like, they eat their own food as well. The most fun part, I would say, would be the Lego place, where we got to see, like, little kids building stuff, which is kind of like the future of makers. And it was nice. And we saw, you know, a lot of Mennonites, and we went to see this old antique store where they actually make brooms. So that was really cool. We actually got to see them make brooms. And they're the last broom makers in Canada, so that was pretty interesting.
As we learned more about these unique people and the things they made, many students found themselves inspired. Some crafted elegant Halloween costumes, others made delicious cakes, and some of them created their own maker culture events. Enter the education group, Nicole Vierman, Jim Saunders, and Steve Howard at the University of Western Ontario. They organized a live stream debate about the edupunk movement. I caught up with Jim to talk about it.
It kind of started off as an idea in back a few months ago now in class, and we're like, well, there's no kind of events happening in Ontario, so let's go ahead and, in true maker culture fashion, make our own event and bring people together to talk about edupunk. So that's what we did, and kind of like, okay, let's kind of not bite off more than we can chew. Let's start slow. Let's kind of plan this out. And so as the weeks have gone by, we've kind of assembled the panel slowly. We've got Jim Groom on board, the guy who coined edupunk. And then we've got a few other people who are in the London area who are kind of self-educating themselves.
The debate that sparked out of their project really showed us that the creation of intellectual material was just as important to the maker culture movement as physical objects. Here's an excerpt from that debate.
I'm interested in what you guys were just discussing, and this question of, like, can innovation, curiosity, and passion be taught or not? And I'm not sure, I mean, passion, innovation, whether it could be taught or not, I'm not sure whether it can or not, but I know for sure that it can be routinely and systematically rooted out of students over the course of 12 years from K to 12. And if you look at how our systems are set up right now in K to 12 in the U.S., you know, I mean, not all the time are they doing that, but 9 times out of 10, with the way they set up these kind of tests and the testing logic of schools and the SOLs, I mean, schools have become this kind of battle zone for all of society's problems, right? Like, how come our kids aren't learning at the same rate? How come these completely poor kids aren't learning as fast as these completely rich kids who have completely different school systems with completely different resources? I mean, so school becomes this unbelievably controversial and political battlefield whereby we're trying to deal with all of society's problems and kind of understand this. And through that process, I think routinely rooting out and weeding out any sense of innovation, but also any sense of curiosity and any sense of kind of wonder at teaching and learning. And so I don't think it's surprising by the time you get into post-secondary that a lot of that is rooted out of you and you're still very much within a process. Now, is there room for innovation and imagination both in K-12 and higher ed? Sure. But not nearly as much as it should be when we think about what education should be and what this should be as a process of discovery. And I think we're seeing very little, if any, innovation in higher ed when it comes to these digital media. I mean, you'll hear about a couple of things in the higher ed, but in the Chronicle of Higher Ed or stuff like that. But when you think about what the business world is doing and these other kind of spaces are doing compared to education, it's kind of, you know, it's shockingly terrible, given that education for so long has been the space where you're going to lead innovation, you're going to grow innovation, you're going to grow research and development, and it's going to spill out into the other sectors of any given economy, of any given nation. Well, it's not working like that. It's actually working the opposite, where all these companies are developing these amazing things, and education is just trying to get them for free, despite what their central IT wants to do, because they're so screwed up. We just have to pull from these different things like WordPress or Google or Wikipedia, you know, just to get a kind of system that halfway works. And so I think it's actually, you're starting to see that implosion of a system that has kind of, for too long, taken its position within society for granted. and it's positioned that it will always have a captive audience of people who pay to get that education. They'll always pay $30,000 to $40,000 a year for it, and that, you know, what they're doing can't be done elsewhere. And I think it can be done elsewhere. Now, it doesn't mean schools go away, but I think they have to completely rethink their model, and on several levels. But I do think that is a real issue.
And that's it for this first episode of Maker Culture, taking things into our own hands. In the next 9 episodes of this podcast series, you are going to learn about many different makers, their creations, aspirations, and even how you can be a maker too. Please join in the discussion on Babbel at rabble.ca/Babbel or on the Tai at thetai.com. We'd love it if you subscribe to this series on the Rabble Podcast Network at rabble.ca/RPN or on iTunes so you can get the next episode fresh from our maker hands to your ears. We're going to leave you with a song from Acres and Acres in the spirit of maker culture. This is the Cell Phone Song. You can learn more about Acres and Acres at www.myspace.com/acresandacres. Thanks for listening. And remember, it's your world. What are you going to make of it?
All your cell phones ring. You keep in touch with everything. And all your friends online, even the ones you left behind. You're never out of touch, but you're always alone. And the woman in the advert looks so happy with your cell phone. Oh, you're never out of touch, but you're always alone. Sing batteries and everything, and cable and all that choice just becomes background noise. Always alone, and no one on the TV nice as you ever grows lonely this long. Well, you never out of touch, but you're always alone.